So now we'll compare this model to the cluster state model of quantum computation. And in this model, we saw in the circuit model all the qubits start in a product state. But in the cluster state model, all qubits start in some generic entangled state. And this is the input for the computation. And then we do single and two-qubit unitary gates on the circuit model, okay? And the computation on the cluster state model is just done by doing single-qubit measurements, okay? Just we measure the qubit one by one, and we actually kind of destroy this entangled state. And this is how we proceed the measurement. And again, the outcome is given by just single-qubit measurements, although this is kind of incorporated here. Here, the outcome is given by doing single-qubit measurements. So now, I'm going just to describe you just a mathematical description of what are these cluster states, OK? It's very simple, actually. So the best way to describe the cluster state is just graphically, OK? So the way we're going to do it, we are going to denote a circle, a qubit which starts in the state, say, plus. Okay, and plus here is 0 plus 1. Okay, 0 and 1 are, say, two possible states in the Hilbert space. And a green line between two circles represents an application of a matrix, which we call a control Z gate, which is just written over there, which doesn't do anything unless both qubits are in the one state, and then it multiplies the state by a minus sign. Okay, and note that it doesn't. If now I can draw a graph, an arbitrary graph of qubits, and connect them arbitrarily by these green lines. And what you have to know that all these green lines kind of commute. Okay, all these operators, all these matrices commute. So the order in which I apply these matrices doesn't matter. Okay, so a cluster state is this graph connecting circles with green lines. Let's just see two quick examples. So for two qubits, if I start them off in the plus state and I apply the control Z, then you see that I get this state with the minus sign for the 1-1 state. And then this is just can be written as plus 0 plus minus 1 minus times 1. Okay, and this is just a maximally entangled two-qubit state. Can everybody see this? Is this clear? Okay, it's just equivalent to any other Bell state that you can think of. Okay, for three qubits, you can actually see that the CZ is kind of a controlled gate where plus changes to minus if the first qubit is in the one state. So if we start off by doing the CZ here, remember it doesn't matter which order I do this, then I get the state up there, and then when I come in with the third qubits, I get this state, plus 0 plus, and minus 1 minus, where now this is equivalent to what we call in quantum information sometimes a GHZ state. It's kind of a Schrödinger cat state for three qubits. Okay? So it's a small kitty, not a very big cat. But if I would add more qubits in this kind of fashion, I would get like a Schrödinger cat. Now, a few interesting things about this cluster state. So you see for a GHZ state, a GHZ state, I mean a state like this, okay, 0, 0, 0 for however qubits, and then 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? This kind of state, if you take out one of the qubits, if you trace it out, the superposition decoheres. Okay? Where in for the cluster state, okay, which comprises of more than three qubits, if I take out one of the qubits, it doesn't decohere the whole state. It just inflicts kind of a damage on only the nearby qubits. Okay? So the entanglement is kind of very, it's in the jargon, it's called persistent, but it's kind of localized. Okay? You can take out one qubit and still have an interesting state for the rest of the qubits if you have enough of them. Okay? So any questions so far? OK. So we can actually use this kind of states to perform a computation just by doing measurements. And I'm going to do this in two steps. First, I'm going to show you on some level of rigor that we can make an arbitrary unitary gate by making measurements on this kind of state. Okay? So the way we have to think about this is we have, say, 3 qubits. Okay, this is the kind of the simplest example. And then we measure them, but we measure 3 qubits in a basis, each time in a different basis, where the basis is characterized by this alpha angle. And you already see, by just by counting parameters, that this should, just by counting parameters, see that you have enough parameters to perform an arbitrary rotation, right? Because an arbitrary rotation consists of, say, 3 Euler angles, okay? And here we have 3 measurements with 3 different parameters, which act as the Euler angles for the rotation. Okay, so actually, if you do the math, performing these 3 rotations is equivalent to applying these gates on a qubit which starts in the plus state. And just I'll just say this matrix here is just this matrix. It's called the Hadamard. And the point is that once you conjugate this kind of matrix, which is just a rotation around the z-axis, by 2 Hadamards, you get a rotation around the x-axis. So this actually really comprises of 3 Euler angle rotations for the qubit that starts in a generic state. Okay? So the point to take from here is that we can perform, if we think of this line as a qubit and we perform 3 consecutive measurements, we end up with a state that is a state rotated to an arbitrary direction by just the choice of measurements. Is that clear? Okay. Okay. And now, what else do we need? So we saw we can actually imitate this arbitrary single qubit unitary. Okay. We also need to do this 2-qubit unitaries. So the way, if you think of a circuit-based computation. Going this way with time, okay, as time proceeds and gates are being applied, measurement quantum computation would start with a generic cluster state. You see, it's a kind of a two-dimensional array in some sense, okay? And it would proceed by measuring these qubits and applying this unitary. And the 2-qubit unitary, this is not exact in any way, but the 2-qubit unitaries would be done by measuring qubits. So each qubit is, each line here corresponds to a line here, and the 2-qubit gate would be applied by having these lines connecting 2-qubit lines in this 2-dimensional array. Okay? So again, every line here corresponds to a line here in the cluster state, and every single unitary gate is applied by doing just measurements on the qubits as we go along. So time is replaced by space. And 2-qubit gates can be done if we have lines connecting these qubit lines. And again, this is not exact in any, this is just a caricature, okay? So now the question is, how do we build a photonic cluster state? And why do we want to build a photonic cluster state? Because this kind of scheme is kind of optimal for photons. Why? Because photons, photons are very easily, very precisely measured by just linear optical devices that we already know for, you know, I don't know how many centuries. Okay, so just by, if we can only do single qubit measurements on photons, we're in very good shape in the sense of precision. The point is, however, that there's no easy way to get photons to interact. Okay? Photons are very weakly interacting particles. And if we want to, get them into an entangled state, the efficiency of, it is possible, but the efficiency of this procedure would be very, very low. So it's very hard to do this kind of scheme. So on one hand, this is a drawback of photons. Of course, this can all be also be thought of as a advantage if we want to avoid decoherence, okay? Since they're very weakly interacting, they are very little sensitive to the interaction with an environment. Okay, so now for quantum dots. So what I'm thinking about are what people call strain-induced self-assembled quantum dots. These are just, you take two semiconductor materials with different lattice constant, and then what happens is that in the interface, you get a lot of stress between two materials, and these bumps appear. And these bumps, because they are they are potential well for both positive and negative charge carriers, just because it's a band structure effect. Okay, so we can trap holes and electrons in these bumps, in these quantum dots. And once an electron and a hole recombines, a photon is emitted. And the polarization of the photon depends on the angular momentum of the electron and the hole. Okay? Which I don't draw in this diagram. And now I'll be interested in two specific transitions. There are many transitions possible in these quantum dots, right? I can place the electron and the hole on all these different levels. I can have more than one electron, more than one hole. So there is a zillion possible optical transitions in these quantum dots. But I'm interested in two very specific ones, okay? And these two specific ones are the following. We have a doubly degenerate ground state of a dot when just a single electron is present, okay? So the spin state of the electron, okay, is the kind of the qubit for the dot, okay? So there is two possible spin states for the electron. And we can now excite each of these states to a state with plus 3/2 and minus 3/2 angular momentum. So what happens, just very briefly, is that we add another electron and another hole. And the holes in this case, for some reason I don't want to get into, have spin 3/2. Okay, the electrons sit in a singlet state, so spin 0. So the total spin of this state, total angular momentum of this state is 3/2. Total angular momentum of this state is minus 3/2. And now if photons are, say, propagating in the z direction, then to get from here to here, I can only do this with a left circular polarized photon, okay, which adds a minus 1 angular momentum, okay? And from here to here, I can only go with a right circular polarized photon, which adds 1 angular momentum. Okay, is that clear? So these are two optical transitions that I want to consider. And let's see what we can do with them. So one thing we can do is the following. Okay, so here you have the diagram. You can look at this if you're confused. Suppose, for some reason, I start in a superposition of the electron in the up plus down state. Don't bother yourself thinking how I do this, because it's completely irrelevant. Okay? Now I excite coherently this state, say with a linearly polarized light, and I get a superposition of these excited states. And this superposition decays, okay? And now we have the electron back either in the up or down state, but the photon emitted has a right or left circular polarization. Okay? Now I can do this again and get another photon, and I get now this more complicated superposition, but now you see that this is a GHZ state, right? Again, we have a right circularly polarized photon when the spin is up, a left when the spin is down, and so forth. If we go on with this, we'll get some kind of Schrödinger cat. Now, this is not what we want. First, this kind of state, we can't use it for implementing quantum computing on the practical side. Also, notice there is no other real good way to measure the spin of the electron other than producing another photon. So at any rate, I'm going to, at some stage, have to trace out the state of the electron. So I'm always going to kind of end up with an incoherent mixture of this part and this part. Okay? And okay, GHZ states are very, very susceptible to decoherence. But the main thing is that this is not useful for quantum computation, and we want something that is. So I'm going to add another ingredient to the scheme. And this ingredient is just a static magnetic field in the XY plane, where the quantization axis of all these things is the Z axis, say. So I'm going to add an in-plane magnetic field, and the in-plane magnetic field rotates between these two states. Okay? So now what happens? Okay, suppose we somehow, doesn't matter again how, because it doesn't, we don't have to do this step, but somehow we initialize spin, completely irrelevant. We let it evolve for some specific time. Okay, we know the strength of the magnetic field, so we know how much it has to evolve in order to reach this state. Okay? And then we do this excitation and decay, and this is an ideal cluster state machine gun, and I assume that this excitation and decay happens happens immediately, I mean, on the zero, with zero time. Okay? I don't consider the time scale for this to happen. Now we have, as before, an upspin with a right circular photon and a downspin with a left circular photon. And now I let it evolve again for some time. The spin again rotates, okay, and to another superposition of up plus down. And then I excite and I do this excitation and let it decay. Now I'm starting to get a different state than I got before. Okay, it's not clear still what is this state. And actually, I'll need you to trust me here that if I continue this procedure, what I'm actually doing, I'm actually making a linear cluster state where, just look at this side of the diagram for a second, where this is the spin of the quantum dot. This is the photon that I emitted first, okay? And this is the photon I emitted last, okay? So it's a linear chain, a linear cluster state of the spin and the photon. In this diagram, we have these unitary matrices are what we call the Hadamard, and they are implemented just by the precession of the spin in the magnetic field. Okay? And the C naughts here, okay, this is a C naught gate, so what it does, if the spin state is in zero, it doesn't do anything. If the spin state is in one, flips the spin of this second qubit. Okay, so this is equivalent to making the excitation and decay procedure. Okay, just I insert the photons in a fiducial state. Okay, so and this is a completely equivalent to doing the excitation, because if the spin is in the down state, in the up state, then we have a right circular photon. If the spin is in the down state, we have a left circular. Then we have a left circular photon. Okay, so it always starts in the zero state. So this diagram is exactly equivalent to the procedure I described before, and still this is ideal, and it produces a linear chain. Okay. So any questions so far? Yeah.
So you asked us to ignore the issue of initialization and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not willing to do that. So
yes.
Can you just say a little bit more about the actual physical way that you're doing this, including the initialization and...
So you don't need to initialize. The point is that... Yeah, I just for demonstration. But the point is that you can just, in a cluster state, you could just disconnect by just measuring, say, one of these photons. And then you don't care. Yeah, I just show, yeah.
So on the...
I wrote this intentionally, not just for pedagogical reasons, just to in order to see how we build this state. But in... You could start with a mixed state of up plus down, and then just cut the chain, and then I'll show you in a second. You'll understand why it doesn't matter. Okay. Okay. Maybe it's not clear.
So
just wait.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. So you're saying that it's not just that you don't want to talk about it at the moment; it's that it really doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
You can start with a completely mixed state of this thing.
I see.
Okay. Yeah.
So the excitation and decay. Why don't, when you excite it, why don't you also get the plus a half, minus a half state?
Yes, okay, it's a very good point. Thanks for asking the question. So in these quantum dots, the nice thing is that there is no rotation, full rotational symmetry, okay? So the state, there are states with plus and minus half, but they are on very different energies. They're called, so in the semiconductor physics, these are states of heavy holes, and there is also states of light holes, okay? The light holes have very different energy just because of the exact Fromley Hamiltonian and the band structure of the material. So they would be somewhere up here, and if I excite with a certain energy, I'll just not be able to excite them. So this is very different from an atom or an ion sitting in a cavity. Thanks for asking the question.
Okay.
This is why these transitions are optimal for producing this kind of state. Okay, so are we happy with this diagram, or anybody else wants to ask questions here? Is it clear what's happening? These are the excitations, and these are just the rotations done by just precessing the spin in the magnetic field. Okay. So life is hard, and there is a lot of imperfections, actually, when you come to do this protocol. Okay. First thing is that I've assumed the assumption that the excitation and decay happen immediately is not correct. Okay. So you have to take this into account. And second thing is that the spin of the electron sitting in the quantum dot interacts very strongly with the environment. Okay? And it interacts, so there is two different decoherence mechanisms that can occur. Something I call dephasing, and when people characterize this by a time, they call it T2 time. And spin relaxation called T1 time. Okay, so spin relaxation just means that, say, the spin goes to its ground state. Okay, and dephasing, we'll talk about it soon. And then other problems like photon loss, okay, and imperfect selection rules. In some materials, these selection rules are not exact. And this can also cause some imperfections of this protocol. Now, I want to. So photon loss is a problem, always problem with linear, when you want to use photons for quantum computing. I want to consider it as a technical problem. Also, there are ways, it's actually, I'm not going to say this in a precise way, but it's actually better to lose a photon than to know you've lost a photon than have an error on a photon. Because if you have an error, you kind of don't know that it's there. If you lose a photon, at least you know you've lost it. There's a way to try to recuperate from that. Okay, not a rigorous statement. So I'm not going to consider these two details. Actually, this can be turned into a photon loss in a way I don't want to discuss. And I just want to discuss this known zero lifetime of the excited state and this decoherence due to the interaction with the environment. So I'm not going to go into the math, but what does the fact that the excited state have a finite lifetime due to us. So what it does now, just think that since the decay time takes a finite amount of time, the spin state of the electron in the dot is entangled kind of with the time the photon was emitted. Okay? So if I trace out over this time, I kind of don't measure the time in which the wave packet was actually emitted, then I cause decoherence on the spin. Okay? Is that clear in any way? Okay? So also, we can say that the wave packet of the photon serves as some kind of environment for the spin and decoheres it. Okay? Second thing, also very serious, is the interaction with the environment and the way the Hamiltonian works is the following, okay, that we actually have a separation for three timescales. There is the decay time, there is the T2 time, which is larger, and the T1 time is much larger, and it's actually, we can think about it as infinity, okay? If in the end anybody will ask, I'll explain exactly why. And the dephasing, what I mean by dephasing is that the Bloch sphere John was talking about before shrinks along the y-axis, okay? So there is a preferred axis here, which is the direction of the magnetic field, say, okay? And the Bloch sphere shrinks around this axis in a very short time scale, which is the T2 time, okay? So it decoheres, okay? And this is due to the interaction of the spin with its environment. Okay? Now, this is what would have happened only to the spin. If I would just think of only a spin, no, suppose there are no photons, only a spin, I prepare it in some state, okay, some state along the Bloch sphere, it would have to shrink along with the way the Bloch sphere shrinks here. So it would decohere. Okay? So it kind of looks hopeless because these times are short. We want to produce a lot of photons, okay, to make it feasible for quantum computation. And the speed is going to decohere fast, and we're not going to get enough photons out of this. And it's kind of despairing. But so the questions that we have to ask ourselves, so does the state degrade with the number of photons? Okay, and are we limited by the T2 time? Okay, now the only reason I'm giving this talk is that the answer is no. Okay, otherwise it would not be so interesting. Actually, the process can continue irrespective of T2 time in the sense I'm going to describe, and the error localized in the sense that there is each photon comes out with some constant independent probability of error. Okay, so there is some error, some probability of having an error on say a photon, okay, and this probability is constant. And for two photons, the probability would be p squared and so on. Okay, is that clear? So now I'm going to try to explain why this happened. Okay, so this is the ideal thing. Okay, this is the ideal scheme of generating the linear cluster state, and both the dephasing and the finite lifetime of the excited state are equivalent of putting a y error somewhere along here. It doesn't matter where, although the y and the Hadamard don't commute, but don't worry about that. We can put the y errors anywhere along this line. The point is that the y error is equivalent. It's equivalent. Putting a y error here is equivalent for putting a y error and a z error on two subsequential photons, okay? And no error on the spin. So this is just a mathematical statement. So I'm going to say it again. Having a y error somewhere during this evolution, so this is kind of the completely positive map described, which describes this y error, is equivalent for putting a y error and a z error on these two photons, okay? And you see that this do not propagate farther in the state. This is just localized error on the photon, okay? They do not. So now I can go to the next step, and the next step for the photon, for creation of a new photon, looks completely equivalent. So far as the speed is concerned, the next step looks completely equivalent. It doesn't care if there wasn't an error before, okay? And now you can actually calculate using, if you know the Hamiltonian of your system and the relevant parameters, you can actually calculate what is this probability of error, okay? And so this is just saying that this error is localized. And let's see what's the energy scales here in the problem. So the energy scales is that the decay time of the excited states is about 100 picoseconds. Okay, and the important time for the decoherence is the T2 time, okay, which is about 1 microsecond. And now the magnetic field, what happens is the following. So this is kind of an optimization problem. If I put a very high magnetic field, okay, the spin rotates fast. So in each cycle, it doesn't accumulate a lot of dephasing, right? It rotates very fast. The dephasing doesn't act for very long. So that's good. But on the other hand, if the magnetic field is high, then we get spectral which path information just because we are splitting the eigenstates in the magnetic field. So we can't put a magnetic field that's too high. So this is a contour plot of the possible of the amount of error on each one on each photon, okay? And on this axis, so everything here is related to the lifetime of the photon of the excited state. Gamma is the inverse lifetime, okay? And you see, if I go to too high magnetic field, I start to increase the error. Okay, But if I go to a magnetic field that's too low, then the errors grow up again because the dephasing acts for a longer time. Okay? And this is the ratio between the T2 time and the decay time. Okay? And for these parameters, it's about 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 4. It depends exactly. Each quantum dot is a different story. So if you know your quantum dot, say, and you know that this ratio is 10 to the minus 4, you can now choose what is the optimal magnetic field in which you want need to work. Okay? And this would tell you what is the optimal, what's the minimal amount of error you can have. Okay? Now, just as the last thing, so I just up until now showed you how we construct a linear cluster state, okay? But we saw in the beginning that what I actually need is some kind of a two-dimensional array in order to perform the calculation, okay? So this actually can be done by a very minor change in this protocol, and the change is the following. So sometimes instead of doing a pi over 4 rotation, I do a pi over 2 rotation, okay? So by doing a pi over 2 rotation, I kind of have these legs sticking. So this is the linear chain I would have without changing the pulse rate. And by making this minor change, I would construct legs sticking out of each one of the photons in the chain, okay? And now I can just, suppose now I have these chains with legs sticking out, I can, you know, curl them on themselves, and then I can project this two photons on an entangled state. There is some probability to succeed. You can't do it perfectly, okay? And then you can be left with a two-dimensional array where some bonds are missing. Some bonds are there, but this will be good enough to perform the calculation. Not all bonds will be there, because in using linear quantum optics, it's impossible to have a perfect projection on a belt. So questions on this?
Yeah. Are you correcting the y and z errors, or are you just?
I'm not doing, not correcting. I'm just producing. Okay.
You're just the manufacturer.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I guess in manufacturing terms, you just warrant that the error level is definitely below this.
Exactly. Exactly. And actually, the errors I showed you, I just showed you for the y errors, but actually all errors localize. Z error localizes too, and x of both of them, so x localizes as well. Okay, so all kinds of errors localize.
The error rates you need to use this stuff, or is that
no? This is something actually I don't know. I would say also that the errors I showed you is a gross overestimate of the real errors, because we took kind of a Markovian approximation, and if we were now working, so let me just say this. The conclusions. So what I showed you, how a single quantum dot can produce large strings of 1D cluster states, and this can be turned into a two-dimensional array of cluster state. The error is localized, okay? The process can proceed for times actually bigger than both T1 and T2. I explained only kind of the T2 time, but also T1 does not stop the protocol. And an outlook, so first, as you said, we need to understand how to use this state. I'm not saying I've done this. You could use coupling between a different quantum dots in order to have a more efficient generation of an array, okay? You can consider other single photon sources that has less dephasing, less interaction with the environment. And actually, you can get much better bounds than the ones I showed you. So I have assumed, most of you haven't noticed, but I have assumed kind of a Markovian dynamics, in the sense that I assume that there is a CP map acting at each step. But actually, this is first not correct, in the sense that the evolution of the spin is really non-Markovian. But we can still bound it with a Markovian error model. But we can actually do it. We now realize that we can do it with we can get much better bounds than the ones I showed you, which are still very low. I don't know if you've noticed. So the error rates you can achieve with current, say if you use this bounds, there is no problem to get in this region, so 0.03 or something like that. Okay? And that's it. Thanks.
Questions?
Is it a firm?
Yeah, so that's the whole point, is to make it experimentally feasible. That's why we wanted to consider the simplest scenario for experimentalists, where they actually don't need to implement gates on the spin of the quantum dots. The only thing they need to do is actually put a constant magnetic field, which is easy, and do these excitations, which is also easy. There is some tricky issues there, but the main problem for experimentalists is actually doing measuring correlations and showing that they have an interesting state. This is kind of the main problem for experimentalists.
One more. Did I miss where you addressed the question of preparation?
Yeah, if the error is localized, you can think of having a mixed state, like having an error on the first spin. That would only, if you cut the chain, that would only kind of incur an error on the next spin and so forth. So.
Right, I'm just having trouble figuring out what the actual picture that you have is. So you have to prepare these things in some state, and you do that by just saying it's ground state of the.
Yeah, so for example, the way you should do it, so you gate your quantum dots, so you put some kind of electric potential where in the ground state of the dot contains one electron. Now, this is the ground state. Now, the spin is still free, okay? Now, there's no way to get rid of this electron unless you go to a very high energy process. You don't need to initialize the spin state. But, although you could. You think initializing the spin state would just be measuring the first photon, for example. So if you really insist, it would be done.
Let's thank Nathaniel again.